Okay. So, as Ratnaviha mentioned, we are starting off on a new series of four talks. So mine is the first talk in the series, but also the introduction to the whole series, as well as covering some of the material in the series. And the series is the Noble Eightfold Path. It's if you've been around Buddhism for any length of time, you could not have but heard about the Noble Eightfold Path. The Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path go very much hand in hand. I'll talk a little bit about it in a little while. But first, I want to take you back to 1993. So that's when I was, I just moved to Wellington and I wanted to learn to meditate. And I was about 10 years old now. I was about 23. And I really wanted to learn to meditate. I didn't have that much interest in Buddhism at that time. But I thought meditation was something I wanted to try, at least. And I looked around and I saw a few courses kind of advertised. I remember seeing a poster by a Hindu group called Raja Yoga, and there was another, I think, some leaflets or something by the Transcendental Meditation people. And then I happened to, it was in the Wellington Library, I went there and I saw this poster, and it said, I still remember the words, and it said, "The purpose of meditation is not to have good meditations, but to transform oneself." It was advertising an 8-week meditation course at the Wellington Buddhist Center. And something about those words really, really struck me. I thought, yeah, this seems kind of more substantial. I kind of almost had an innate sense that meditation ought to be more than just a kind of a nice experience or some kind of out-of-the-world mystical experience. I mean, if that happened, that'd be great. But in a way, then what? So I kind of had this intuitive sense that it's got to be more to the spiritual life, to meditation, than just kind of a nice experience. There's got to be more kind of meat to it. And those words that the purpose of meditation is to transform oneself really kind of grabbed me. So I went on to do the meditation course, and here I am, many years later, still around. And I think it is because it offered me a path that was more than just a good experience. It offered me a path of transformation, of changing, in a way, all aspects of my life, gradually over time, in the light of the inspiration that I might have, I might get from things like meditation. So we'll go a little bit into that. But I think one point that I kind of, for me, that was very clear, and I'd like to make, is that genuine spiritual life, a genuine spiritual path, has to involve transformation. So, I mean, in a way, the question becomes, what do you mean by transformation, and how does this transformation come about? So to answer that, we have to go back a step. What you have to ask, well, what leads you to spiritual path or spiritual life or to the center or to a meditation course in the first place? I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of nice things for you to be doing tonight. What brings you here? What brought you here in the first place? And, you know, I'd like you to just kind of recall that, whatever that was, that inspiration or incident or maybe something someone said that gave you the impetus or the inspiration to go and come to a place like this, to a Buddhist center or to a meditation class, or to talk to someone about things. Because it's not, you know, it's still not very all that common in the world. If you take a look at the percentage of people here compared to everyone in Auckland, it's very, very small. So, you know, what I find it really fascinating, what is it that brings some people to follow the spiritual life or seek something higher than just everyday normal life, and others seem to be perfectly happy with it? And, you know, I can think of my brother. He lives in London, and he's a good guy. He's quite ethical, and we had fairly similar upbringing, same parents, but he has very little interest in spiritual life, at least as I see it. You know, he's he's quite happy with his family and his job, and that's that. And, I mean, I'm not saying that's bad, but it's just interesting to me. It's like, how come that I had this strong yearning even from at a young age in my early 20s, and my brother doesn't. So I mean, as I said, you can. It's good to connect with that, whatever brings you to spiritual life in the first place. And for me, talking personally again, what brought me to spiritual life or to this path was, I would say, a deep sense of wonder about life. I think especially in my teenage years, I had this really deep sense of wonder how mysterious, how amazing it is to be alive. And it's like people go around walking as if everything was normal, yet we don't know anything about it. We don't know where we come from, where we're going, what this thing we life is, you know, what awareness is. What I'm not talking in terms of abstract concept, but just experience, raw experience. What is this thing? Suddenly I wasn't, suddenly I am. How come? Suddenly the world is, suddenly you are. How come? It's like, isn't it mysterious? Isn't it strange? And it's all in a flow. It's all kind of, you can't quite grasp it. It's, you know, you try to think, oh yeah, you figured it out, and you realize that you haven't. So it's there's that side to it. So Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, talks about in this book, The Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. He talks about the kind of different reasons people come to the spiritual path. I've met a number of people over the years who have been interested, and I know the reasons they have become interested. But his kind of experience is much wider, so you know it's interesting to see what he says. And he says in his experience, people come to this path for different reasons. Some come because of a personal tragedy or bereavement. Suddenly their world is shattered and they realize how fragile things are, you know, how things can just change in an instant. A good university friend of mine recently, his wife had a choking, she had a coughing fit, and she drowned in her own vomit, basically. She was dead within minutes. Or just like that. I'm not saying this to shock you. It's like I'm just processing that myself, how suddenly things can change. So it can be incidents like that may bring some people to seek for something more. They can be spontaneous. Some people can have what are called spontaneous mystical experiences. And there's a whole kind of big variety of these. Moment of intense clarity. Suddenly you see the kind of maybe the interconnectedness of everything. This experience of tremendous love or even ecstasy. And these experiences often tend to completely alter the person's view of life. Like it's quite different from the view they had of life until that point. And suddenly they see something in greater depth. They see life in greater depth. Or they experience something like a love that they can't explain, that kind of they can't claim to it in a way. It just happens. You know, poets and artists feel that kind of inspiration sometimes. So that might bring some people to spiritual life. There can be similar deep experiences triggered by time in nature for some people, brought about by deep experience of beauty, particularly through art or literature or poetry or music, something that deeply moves you. It can be through deep and prolonged philosophical thought. You might be interested in philosophy. Not that thought can, in the end, comprehend reality, but it can lead you to kind of the mystery of it all, I think, especially some kinds of philosophy. So some people come to it from that angle. Some people have tried some kind of meditation and they try to systematically cultivate more kind of refined states of consciousness and they're kind of seeking an explanation for that sometimes. It's like, why, how come it works, how come it is, how come something so simple as meditation can bring about these intense states of clarity or happiness or and so on. For some people, it can be through engagement in altruistic activity. If you've been engaged in quite selfless altruistic activity, that can create the conditions for, a deep sense of interconnectedness to arise. And for some people, he says, it's simply the whole experience of life. For those, as you get, apparently some people who, as they get older, are able to see their life in some sort of context, and they can see a kind of pattern there that runs not just through their life, but through the world, through kind of everyone's life. It doesn't happen automatically, otherwise everyone old would be very wise, but apparently it does happen for some people. So these are kind of all the things that may bring us to a spiritual path. And in kind of the language of this teaching of the Noble Eightfold Path, these kinds of experiences are called vision experiences, or they call what's called perfect vision. So they're glimpses of perfect vision. I mean, our vision would be perfect if we could really see the world in its true form. We could really see what Buddhism calls the kind of, you know, things like impermanence, insubstantiality, and ultimate unsatisfactoriness of life as we know it, but also at the same time see what is actually possible, that as human beings we can develop. It's not just that everything is impermanent and then we die and so we think, oh well, I might as well make the best use of it then, party hard, have a big house and live in it and that's it. But it's also a sense of, yes, things don't last, but it's also what is possible, what human consciousness is capable of becoming, as symbolized by the figure of the Buddha. So this kind of is what is in this Noble Eightfold Path is called perfect vision. But as I think we all, if we reflect, we would kind of come to realize somehow perfect vision isn't enough in a way. So then what? Okay, I have this experience, glimpse of perfect vision. Then what? And this takes us back to that something more is needed, something that kind of transformation is needed. It somehow needs to start affecting us, that kind of vision experience. It needs to somehow transform us and start affecting us in different aspects of our life. The way we live, the way we behave, our relationship with other people, whether it's be our partner or people we work with or strangers, how we interact with the society as a large, where are we, you know, is our interaction with the society, say, through our livelihood of benefit, or are we actually causing harm? So it needs to start, if we've really seen life as it is, really seen, say, the interconnectedness or what is possible, that should kind of start to have eventually some ramification in these different aspects of our lives. I mean, I remember as a child, my parents were Hindus and used to, they didn't force me, but I used to go to the temples sometimes, and I used to like quite the atmosphere in a temple. It's kind of this feeling of purity and sanctity. There's kind of a special atmosphere, and there'd be kind of I'd see people who are obviously very moved by, sometimes they'd be kind of singing and all that, and they'd be quite moved by it. And then I remember seeing the same people coming out and not having the decency to give a bit of money to the beggar on the roadside. It's like, to me, there's a disconnect there. It's like, you know, if you're really seeing the kind of something deeper, it must affect you, your actions and your sense of interconnectedness with other people. Otherwise, it's in a way not going very deep. So you know, it's the vision that brings us to the spiritual path, but transformation is what kind of needs to occur if that vision is to become more than just a memory, because that's what happens. A lot of, apparently, visionary experiences are very, very common. I've read a number of books on it, but apparently a lot of people, you know, they may interpret it in different ways. Some people might interpret it as if God is talking to them. Some might interpret it in other ways. But visionary experiences are not that unusual. What is unusual is that actually having a transforming effect, or the person having a kind of a spiritual tradition or path available to them that allows that transforming effect to take place, and and therefore the need for a path. Yeah, and this is what I really like about coming to the topic. I mean, I've kind of gone a bit round, but actually what we've come to is to the heart of this teaching of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's like in Buddhism, different teachings bring out kind of different aspects of the spiritual path. It's like Buddhism can be described in terms of Noble Eightfold Path, the three trainings. There's kind of hundreds of different kinds of lists, and they're all trying to describe the same thing, how we develop spiritually. But I think different teachings bring out different kind of, they have their own strengths. They bring out a certain aspect of the spiritual life. And what, for me, this Noble Eightfold Path teaching does, it brings out, firstly, it brings out this relationship between vision and transformation. It clearly spells out what needs to happen, what comes first, but what also needs to follow. And it also, the second thing it does is it highlights that how far-reaching this transformation needs to be, eventually. I mean, that needs to touch all aspects of our life. It can't be something that's just done on a Monday night. Yes, that may serve as an inspiration, but then it has to go beyond the Monday night. It has to somehow start sinking into your Tuesdays, your Wednesdays, your Thursdays, my Thursdays, my Fridays, and so on. This has to, you know, affect the way I deal with my son when he's not being cooperative and I've got to get to work and I'm losing my temper. It's not going to happen overnight, but there's got to be some relation to that everyday life with the kind of the inspiration we get. So now I think it's a good time to look at what this Noble Eightfold Path teaching is. And my pretty assistant, Ratna Vyuha, is going to help with it.
I've been training for this
yes.
for like years.
We've done this many, many times, still coming up to this.
Yeah, you're an order member.
Yeah. So I just wanted to write the kind of the... It's called eightfold for a reason because there are eight folds in it. Or the original word in Sanskrit is called Arya Ashtanga Marga. Arya translating as noble. Ashtanga means eight. What literally means it eight limbed. So it's as if there were eight sides to it. So it's not like necessarily that this is the first step and this is the second step. This is the third step. It's like they're more or less simultaneous. All eight aspects need to be worked upon simultaneously, with one difference, in that perfect vision comes first. That refers to this initial, what brings us to the spiritual path in the first place. So that's what's called a kind of that glimpse in this teaching, referred to as a glimpse of that perfect vision. The Buddha sees that perfect vision in a way all the time. What we get is a kind of a glimpse of it, and that starts up the whole process of transformation. So from here to here, actually. So what this stage represents is kind of the vision, the first part, and then everything else are basically aspects of transformation of our life. And I think putting them in this way, it starts to kind of opens up that how this teaching kind of shows us how it is possible to work at different levels of our life. So tonight I'll be mostly covering perfect vision and perfect emotion, and then these two perfect speech and action will be next week, and these two the following week, and these two the last week. So we'll go through this teaching over four nights. But I'm giving you a bit of an overview tonight, but I've been talking about this, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this. So there's a Sangharakshita in his book gives a very beautiful simile, which I think really describes the kind of relationship between the different aspects of the teaching very well. So I'll just read it out. By the way, this is a great book. If this series Whets Your Appetite. This is a great book to follow up on this Noble Eightfold Path. So he says, the spiritual growth is like development of a tree. First you have a sapling rooted in the earth, and then one day the rain falls, perhaps quite heavily. The rain is absorbed through the roots of the sapling. The sap rises and spreads into the branches and twigs, and the tree grows. There is a pause, and then the rain falls again. Again the sap rises. This time not only does it spread into the branches and twigs, but leaves begin to unfold. If no rain falls for a time, the tree may wither a little, but eventually more rain comes. There may even be a real cloudburst, a downpour, and then not only does the sap rise into the branches and twigs and leaves, but flowers begin to unfold. The following of the Eightfold Path is like that. First, there is a spiritual experience, a glimpse of reality, or in other words, a moment of perfect vision. This is like falling of the rain. Just as the sap rises and spreads into the branches and twigs, so perfect vision gradually transforms the different aspects of our being. Emotion is transformed, speech is transformed, actions and livelihood are transformed, even volitions and awareness are transformed. And as a result of that moment of perfect vision, to some extent, the whole being is transformed. This process is repeated over and over again, at ever higher levels, until at last the entire being is completely transformed and nothing is left unchanged. One is entirely pervaded by the light of enlightenment. I think a couple of points I'd just like to, things I'd like to point out there. Firstly, I think it's, a lot of us already know this, transformation is not easy. It's not an easy process, and it takes time. So though there may be a sudden inspiration, and at times that has an effect, which may be quite, in a way, quite rapid. I remember going on sometimes on retreats, and coming back with quite a sense of a different view of the world, which lasts maybe at least a few days, but some of that kind of, in a way, carries on. We're not just talking about it's not as simple as like flicking a switch. Transformation takes time. And there's a Buddha who uses a simile in the Pali Canon. He describes the dharma, which is the Buddhist teaching. He says that the dharma is like an ocean. Just as land gradually slides into the ocean, so does one enters the depths of the dharma. It's not something we can just do like that. I mean, but sometimes spiritual path can be presented like that. It's just like hop. You just got to get the right meditation and you go on a retreat and that's it. You're enlightened. No more. Yeah, everything's sorted. But yes, something may click after a retreat, and that has an effect and brings about a transformation. And then, after a while, something more needs to happen. Well, interesting thing. Interesting thing is, transformation itself creates conditions for more perfect vision to arise. So in a way, it's not just that the perfect vision gives rise to transformation. Transformation creates the condition for greater perfect vision, a deeper perfect vision to arrive. And that's how the, in a way, spiritual path progresses. I mean, it's not guaranteed, but I mean, I see that inspiration of perfect vision is it's like a little lamp that's suddenly kind of lit somehow in our life. But it has to be protected, it has to be nurtured. And it may even go off every now and then, but then one needs to relight it. And I think I really like that about this presentation of the path, is it reminds me what I need to do when I lose momentum, in a way. I need to go back to inspiration. I need to reconnect with things that really inspire me, because it's only through that inspiration, through that glimpse of perfect vision, that whole process of transformation can again roll on. I mean, that doesn't mean if we're not feeling inspired that we should kind of just give up and wait for inspiration to arise. It might arise tomorrow. Well, as I said, it works both ways. So sometimes, even if I'm not feeling very inspired, I may still choose to act skillfully. I may choose to act generosity because I know that's creating conditions. That's in line with the glimpse I had. And secondly, and the values that I hold, at least at the best of my times. But also secondly, that it's creating ground for further inspiration to arise further down the track. So it kind of works in both ways. Vision gives rise to transformation, and transformation gives rise to vision. So that's kind of looking at the Noble Eightfold Path as a whole, and as I said, we'll go into the individual ones more in the coming weeks. So coming back to perfect vision, I mean, I've already talked a bit about perfect vision. That's that initial inspiration, you could say, that brings us, it's that glimpse of perfect vision that brings us along to the spiritual path. So that's where it all starts. And the need to keep it alive. But also it's something, I think, as Sanghasha says in that quote, something that needs to happen again and again, something we need to reconnect with. I mean, my own, I was thinking, how has that kind of worked for me? Yes, I had that, in the beginning, I had that intuition of, I had this sense of wonder about life, and I had the sense that, you know, spiritual path had to involve more than just good experiences. At times, I have kind of kept in touch with that over the years. You know, we're talking 23 years now. But at times, I have lost kind of in touch with it in day-to-day life, and sometimes for days at end. But something, I think the reason I'm still here is I know how to get in touch with that again. I know if I'm feeling really, I'm just wondering, why am I here? I know I need to go on retreat, because I know in the past that's what gets me back on track. I realize, oh yes, of course, why didn't I do this before? It's I know how to recreate those conditions that get me back into that sense of inspiration. And I think that has over time given rise to a deeper sense of, a deeper glimpse of that vision. I remember when I was thinking, like, you know, I used to think as a kind of teenager or as a in my 20s, I used to think, oh, well, it's like, you know, I'm on my own. Yes, I have my parents and all that. But at the end of the day, I'm alone. I had the saying, one is born alone and one dies alone. So, you know, essentially, in the world, you're alone. And I think over time I've come to realize, actually, that's not true. And particularly by reflecting on things like impermanence and there's a Buddhist teaching of pratityasamutpada, of what's called conditioned co-arising. I think, and there are practices like the six-element practice where you, which Vajrajyoti talked about last week, I think it was. I haven't got time to go into those, but it's through doing these Buddhist practices I start to get a glimmer of the sense that actually that is not the case. I couldn't even have been born if it wasn't for other people, let alone anything else. It required my parents and their parents and their parents and their parents. It requires a whole world to be born of living beings. Even if I lived on an island where I was self-sufficient, I would still need other living beings, plants or animals, to sustain my life. And in the end, all that I get, I give back. I have to give back this. I can't hold on to it. So I am, in a way, never alone. I never was. It's just, it's my thinking which makes me separate from others. It's kind of, it's what we call that sense of ego identity. Useful as it is in everyday world, it's not, when you start to actually reflect on it, when you start to meditate on it, it's not actually true. So through these glimpses, I've had to start to have a thing, this been like a fundamental shift, I think, at some level, or starting to, in my outlook of the world. And maybe in my emotions and my response to other people. I don't know how it works, all works out, but it's. I think I've noticed that there has been a fundamental shift in my view of life, my view of the world, what I think the world is. And that's what a Buddhist practice can do. That's what the path of transformation can bring about, a deeper vision, which then triggers new processes of transformation. So, you know, those are starting to happen. I don't know how they'll work out. And that's part of the thing. It's an adventure. We don't quite know how, you know, all these aspects. But when you have a perfect vision, you can't predict that that's how it will affect you. In a way, you got to some extent, trust the process. And on the other hand, have support of the people who understand what's happening, have support of the people who may have gone through similar things before, have a bit more experience of spiritual life. And here we're talking about Sangha and the importance of Sangha. And that's something I will come back to in a minute. So yeah, I think that's perfect vision. Leave it at that. So what is perfect emotion? Well, I think Sangrishna points out that that emotion comes kind of, we've shown it right after the perfect vision, and there is a kind of emotion does act as a bit of an intermediary between vision and rest of everything else, because we need to engage our heart to live to walk the path for us to put their practices into play for us to come to the center or go on a retreat and do that on a regular basis over a period of time. We can't do it just out of a sense of duty. We can't do it just because we think it's a good idea. I remember a friend of mine telling me, he said he had a grandmother in a distant city, and he knew he should go and see her. And he never quite used to make it. He might make it, you know, once a year or twice a year. He knew he should do it, and it's a good thing. And then he happened to get a girlfriend in the same town. And suddenly he was there every fortnight or every month. So obviously, you know, something changed. Something else got involved, his heart and maybe other parts of his anatomy. But but something, it's like, you know, some of his unconscious energies somehow got engaged. That wasn't, even though earlier he knew it was a good idea, it wasn't quite happening. So I think that's what we're referring to here, is that if the experience is deep enough, we feel it starts to affect our emotions, our and it provides us, and those emotions, those provides us, in a way, we start to get the cooperation. I don't think we can control emotions. Like we either have cooperation of our emotions or not, in a way. So they start to be more cooperative and to go in the direction that we think is a good idea to go to. So what do you think would be the effect of, say, if you had a glimpse of perfect vision, what would it be the effect of that on our emotions? Would we become more selfish if we really saw had the effect of perfect vision? Would we get more possessive of things? Would we feel more kind of cut off from other people? Would that be the effect of glimpses of perfect vision? I think it's quite, in a way, it's quite obvious that an experience like that really opens us up, in a way, opens us, gives us a, and in a way, cultivates, it brings about a change in our emotional life, which is quite the opposite of what I was just talking about. Buddhism talks about it in two ways. It talks about things kind of that decrease and the things that kind of increase when perfect vision starts to have an effect on our emotional life. Those glimpses start to have an effect on our emotional life. So what decreases is things like craving, neurotic craving, kind of hatred, resentment. We develop a greater sensitivity to life, so we can't be so blatantly cruel to other life, to other people. So one should expect to see those things happening. And on the looking at the same thing in a positive way, you could say what we start to develop is things like what are called the very the Brahma Viharas, or to use a more ordinary term, more wholesome states of mind. So these are things like metta, which is translated as friendliness or kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita is joy in the joy of others, and upeksha, which is kind of like an equanimity in face of ups and downs of life. And there are, so, but there are also other kind of positive emotions. Those are not the only ones. I mean, one thing I was thinking, I realized when I go on a retreat, especially a longer retreat, one time I know the retreat is working when I feel humbled during the retreat. There usually is a point during a long retreat when I feel, it's not that I'm feeling I'm bad, but it's like something greater has opened up. I've suddenly come into touch with something much more open-hearted, something greater, and I feel, but comparison to that, my life kind of feels a bit narrow, or a bit, just not given chance that what I could be. So, and then it's an uncomfortable emotion. It's called Hri in Buddhism. Buddhism has a name for it. Hri also translates as kind of shame. But it's like a positive shame. It's a sense of the fact that I realize I'm not living up to the level that I could be, or not living up, a lot of the time I'm not living up to the inspiration that I have at the best of my times. And it's uncomfortable, but it doesn't put me down. It's, on the contrary, it actually gives me the impetus and opens me up to kind of, it engages my emotions. That's something I've come to appreciate. And another example I was thinking of this is, I find when I'm in touch with some, particularly some good friends that I really, well, I feel they have achieved a lot in their kind of spiritual life. They've gone quite a way, and there's a kind of presence to them. I feel when I'm with them, I'm just naturally more ethical. I can't act in my kind of resentment ways and things like that. in their presence, I can't. That's, I think, the effect of a greater perspective, or being in touch with something a more open-hearted person can have on us. So it's that sort of area we're talking about in the perfect emotion. There's two things that I'm going to talk about in perfect emotion, and then I'll come to a close. And there's a lot that can be said about perfect emotion. It's a whole talk in itself, and I've only had about 15 minutes in this. So I'll just pick on two things, and one of them is gratitude, and that's something I think it's kind of an easy way into perfect emotion, or into developing wholesome emotional states, because what a gratitude does is it gives us a sense of what has been done for us. The literal translation of the word we translate as gratitude is a recognition of what has been done for oneself. So I do this kind of, I've been doing this thing recently, where at the end of the day I just think of three things that I'm grateful for, that I really do feel grateful for. It could be anything. It could be the fact that I met a really good friend that day, or that I've got a loving family, or that I've got that I know how to meditate, and I had a good meditation that all those years ago I learned to meditate, being grateful for that. Or it can be anything. But I'm finding it a very useful practice, just at the end of the day, thinking of three things and connecting with that sense of gratitude that I feel to life, to others, to the world, and because it brings me again into a relationship, into contact, and kind of works against that feeling of me as separate, as cut off from everyone else, and no one cares about me. Not that I always think about that, but those are the narratives that can go on in our mind, and gratitude really works against that. And maybe times you don't feel gratitude, that's fine too. And what I've started seeing starting to happen is I'm starting to feel, or I'm starting to recognize that gratitude when it happens more during the day, because of this practice, because I'm kind of recollecting it at the end of the day. So I may be going down, for a walk at where I work, and it's these beautiful grounds, and I feel grateful that I am able to have a job where I can be in such beautiful natural surroundings. So, yeah. So that's one thing you could try. Think three things you're grateful for at the end of every day. Try that for a couple of weeks. See what happens. And the other one is the importance of Sangha, of the spiritual community. I think the thing about perfect emotion or emotional life is it's not lived in isolation. Most of our emotions, if not all, are connected with other people. You know, they're influenced by other people. They're in relation to other people, whether it's generosity or resentment or whatever it is. It's usually in there's other people involved. And what a Sangha or spiritual community does is provides, in a way, a working ground for it. Because otherwise, well, you know, where do we... I mean, yes, it's going to play out anywhere, wherever we are, in work, at work, or at home life. But in a spiritual life, we got shared values where we're all trying to live kind of by those values and trying to develop and behave in a kindly and more sensitive way to each other. So it does highlight when things don't go right. At work, you can just brush it off because other people don't care. But in a spiritual community, in a genuine spiritual community, you can't. And when we come to the spiritual life, when we come to the, in relation to other people, spiritual community, we bring with us our usual dispositions. We bring with us our need for our status. We bring for us our prejudices, our kind of playing of roles. So two things are possible when we're all doing this. Either the spiritual community, the Sangha, just becomes a group. That's possible. Or it gives us a reason to look at what we're doing, and therefore maybe give rise to a new way of behaving than our usual patterns. And spiritual community, I should have said, when I say spiritual community, what I mean is not a membership of a kind of some sort of institution, but a sense of that they're of a group of practitioners. You know, I'm trying to practice and figure out this mystery of life, and you are trying to do that. And sure, some of us have got something to teach others, but you know, we all come with something. It's not always that the person giving the talk has all the wisdom and you none. It's like this is what spiritual community is an interaction, and we kind of try to. I mean, on a Monday night, it's just you come for a talk and then that's it. But then we interact in other ways, like study groups and with people who work together or even live together. And so these things kind of provide a good working ground. And, you know, ideally everything would be fine in a spiritual community. People would always be nice and kind to each other, but that's not always the case, I'm afraid to say. You know, even at the level of order members, I've seen order members fall out with each other. Happens everywhere, and you know. But what is crucial is usually there's a commitment to working through that, because we hold these common values that we do want to act in kindness with each other, and friendliness and generosity. So when things like that happen, there's usually impetus there to work with it, and in the process of doing that, we can learn something about ourselves. Yeah. So I think the point I want to make here is the spiritual community is a very good working ground for the transformation of our emotions. It's not always easy, but it is a very, very good working ground. Yeah. Okay, I think I'll finish there. That's it.